What up, everyone? Welcome to the Smoke and Tire Podcast. This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. Listen, as folks adapt to this changing world, we're going to be buying more and more stuff online than ever before. And if you're selling online, are you ready to meet the demands of our new delivery-based culture? Be ready with ShipStation. ShipStation is shipping software, and it will help save so much of your time. Let me tell you why. ShipStation helps online sellers of any size get orders out quickly, save money on shipping costs, and keep customers happy. No matter where you're selling, Amazon, Etsy, or your own website, ShipStation brings all of your orders into one simple interface, making them really easy to manage from any device, even from your cell phone. ShipStation works with all the major carriers, including USPS, FedEx, UPS, and even Amazon Fulfillment. So you can compare and choose between the best shipping solution for you and your customer, all within ShipStation. They even offer big discounts on shipping costs. Now, any business can access the same postage discounts that are typically reserved for large Fortune 500 companies. You'll always know you're getting the best deal. It's no wonder that ShipStation is the number one choice of online sellers. You'll ship more in less time with the best rates available. It's even, although we ship our t-shirts through BlipShift directly, it's what I use on my home computer to just do basic business shipping from here at the Smoking Tire. Even if you just have a regular home office and you're not selling professionally, ShipStation can save you time and money. Right now, Smoking Tire listeners can try ShipStation free for 60 days when you use offer code TIRE. Make sure your business is ready to meet the demands of delivery culture. Get started at ShipStation.com today. Just click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and then type in TIRE. That's ShipStation.com. Enter offer code TIRE. ShipStation.com. Make ship happen. We're also brought to you by Crown & Caliber. Guys, they are back. Crown & Caliber has a really fun contest going on right now. They are giving away a $4,500 gift certificate to Crown & Caliber. That'll get you a Rolex, an Omega, Panerai, Breitling. It'll get you something from almost every brand they sell at Crown & Caliber. The drawing ends September 4th, and the winner will be announced September 12th. So go to crownandcaliber.com/Matt. crownandcaliber.com/MATT to enter. crownandcaliber.com/Matt to enter to win a $4,500 gift certificate. Get the watch of your dreams at crownandcaliber.com/Matt. And of course, we're brought to you by Auto Tempest, guys. Your time is valuable. Whether you earn a ton of money at your job or just a little bit of money, you've only got so much time. It's the only thing you can't make more of. So save it with Auto Tempest. Whether you're looking for a new daily driver, a collector car, an exotic sports car, or the basis of a new build, Auto Tempest will search the entire internet on your behalf. You don't need to go to every single individual car site anymore. Or just autotempest.com, and they have you covered. Whether you're searching locally, long distance, they'll search Craigslist, they'll search eBay Motors, they'll search cars.com, they'll search Auto Trader, they'll search Facebook Marketplace, you name it, you just type it in Auto Tempest once, they'll search all of it, bring it back together into one place. We love them and we love their support, and we have a new announcement coming soon with Auto Tempest that will be very, very fun. All right, on this episode, really interested to talk to this guy. I have just finished his book. It is called Why We Drive, and it is a very interesting analysis of the inevitability of the transition to autonomous cars, why that might not be such a good idea, why we shouldn't treat it as an inevitability, and how technology has already shaped our culture and our driving, and the ups and downs of it changing from here. The author is a very interesting dude who also has won awards for his last book, Shop Class as Soulcraft, Matthew B. Crawford, on the Smoke and Tire Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me, man. Your book is awesome. Why We Drive. I really I picked it up, and I'm telling you, I'm a pretty fast reader, but I still, like, I blasted through this thing in about a day and a half, and especially, like, the first 40, 50 pages, every page, I was like, yes, that's the thing, that's the idea. I took a lot of notes, and I want to talk about a bunch of stuff without giving away too much, but thank you for joining me, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and it's good to talk to an actual gearhead, because, like, just earlier today, I was talking to some journalist from the BBC, and he's like, well, Matthew Crawford, clearly you like to drive, but the rest of us would rather not sit in traffic, so what do you say to that, Matthew Crawford?
So frustrating. Yeah. It's so frustrating. It's, when I first picked up your book, Why We Drive, I was kind of expecting it to be sort of, you know, flowery prose of the open road and whatnot, and there's a little bit of that, for sure, but there's also, I think, a very important and nuanced discussion that's much bigger about smart devices and automation and our online lives becoming integrating with real world hardware. And like, oh my God, I have a list of so many things I want to dive in, but like, let's just dive in with a pet peeve of mine that you bring up in the book, which is the assumed inevitability of progress. We all assume the future will be this, but why is that a problem?
Well, you know, there's a whole industry of futurologists who tell us that the future has decided that, for example, we're all going to be rolling around in driverless cars. And I think it's a way of kind of demoralizing any kind of opposition. Well, it's inevitable. There's nothing you can do. But of course, none of this is inevitable. And
everything is the result of a choice, right? Yeah. And a choice that's followed up with an action, and many actions and lots of money, usually, right?
That's right. And we're talking about a massive transfer of wealth if we go down this road of driverless cars.
Right. So I think the philosophy of driverless cars is much, much more interesting than the technology of, can you program a GPS route into a car and make it drive a route, you know, at the ability of an 8-year-old, you know what I mean? But it's really about what are we willing to give up in exchange for a very, very little bit of convenience.
Yeah. I see this as one instance of this wider push. You know, automation is usually the form it takes, and it's a trend in which the demands of skill and competence give way to a promise of safety and convenience. That's usually how it's presented. And the thing is, if you go far enough down that road of de-skilling, the thing is that, like, our skills atrophy from lack of use, right? Just like a muscle, which leads to demands for further automation.
And even like you bring up in the book, mental skills, such as how that, like, our bodies process like memories by making maps of places and associating with location. And if you live in a GPS and you're only ever going places on a GPS and following a line, and you really give yourself over to predictive traffic and stuff like that, you will literally forget, like, you'll have less memories, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's this fascinating connection between the parts of the brain that where you form a map of the world and also where our memories get formed. So memories, it's called episodic memory. So you string together these events in your life, and that's sort of the story you tell about yourself. And events always happen in some place, which is why our memories are always so connected to particular places. And yeah, if you basically offload the task of finding your way through the world to GPS, you're not forming those connections. And on the flip side, you know, the London taxi drivers who have to memorize the entire city, like, their hippocampus is actually bigger in brain scans.
That's an amazing, that whenever, when the London taxi driver versus Uber battle, you know, was going on,
I was so like, I use Uber. Like, I'm not like morally pure. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's really convenient. Like, you know what I mean? What am I going to do? Right. But in London, man, I was so pro London cab driver, because I've been to London and those guys rule. They are like,
they're true professionals.
Yeah. That's like that they study like doctors study. It's like, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's been called the most demanding cognitive test of any kind. It's comparable to passing the bar. Yeah, the knowledge.
You become a GPS, and not just for streets and numbers and stuff like that, but for like weird landmarks and, you know, individual names of restaurants and businesses. It's just, it's craziness what these guys have to do. And then to that we as a society are so willing to give that up to this sort of algorithm that comes from this sort of black box. It's a little sad.
Yeah. And in fact, that's kind of the core theme of the book, is just, I'm impressed with human beings and what they're capable of. And there's a certain perversity in this determination to eliminate the human element from every human activity.
Right.
It starts to look a little bit gratuitous.
Yeah. If you drape it in a cloak of the term safety, right? It's like, oh, saying, oh, hey, this is one of my cats, Nikki, by the way. There's going to be cats just cruising through. It happens. Right. I've got four. But if you drape everything in this sort of cloak of safety, well, who doesn't want a more, you know, who wants a more dangerous world? Who's going to get up on that pulpit and go, I think we should keep the dangerous way. You know, it's hard to argue against safety, but you know, sometimes the cost is really a lot worse than there's other ways, right?
Like, yeah, and the cost is harder to articulate and harder to see it. You know, it's this a subtle sort of degradation of human experience when you just become a passive, independent, basically a passenger in the world. And there's nobody articulating that cost, because it doesn't gear automatically into debates about public policy. And like you say, safety, that's like, once you start talking about safety, you put on a bulletproof halo, right, of, you know.
But there is sort of like a point beyond which you're not, like, man, like you articulated it over many dozens of pages. I don't want to try and boil it down into one sentence, but it's sort of like this, like if that car, in order to take you where you need to go, it needs to know like way more about you than you would really probably be comfortable with any one company knowing about you. You'd be uncomfortable with the government knowing that, and the government has oversight. Like, what does like Google have, or whoever? Like, it's just like this data vacuum, and we have so quickly been like, yeah, no, that's cool. Like, no, have you seen the thing where the doors dance, where you press the buttons? Like, that's cool. Like, you know, and like, and it does little funny, quirky things that really mask the sort of cynical surveillance kind of nature of all of it.
Yeah, because, I mean, your location data, your movements through the world is some of the most valuable information about you, most valuable sort of behavioral data. So I think you have to understand, you know, why is Google getting into driverless cars? What is Google? Well, it's the world's largest advertising firm. And if you don't keep that in mind, you can't really see clearly why they're getting into mobility.
Yeah. I see that in practice. You know, I use a smartphone like everybody else does. And when I, you know, and I drive press cars, right? So every week I'm driving a new car, which is pretty awesome. And I use CarPlay a lot. I have an iPhone 8, and I use CarPlay with it. And I plug it in and boom, it's on the screen, right? And I would say with 40 to 50% accuracy, that predictive destination, here's where I think you're going and here's how long I think it'll take to get there. I think that it's right a lot. Like, it's right a lot. And you go, wow, it's a little scary how right that thing, you know what I mean?
It may know you better than you know yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one thing like
your therapist.
You know, yeah, like back and forth between your office and your house. Like, I kind of get that one. That's an obvious one. But like, it knew I was going to the canyons, like, to go film a car. It was like, here's how long it is to Angeles Crest Highway. I was like, oh shit, you knew that one too, didn't you? I really was going there. But it knew it from the 20 feet from when I left my house. I was like, oh. So how did you end up in this position that you're in of skepticism of this technology?
Well, I mean, I think this kind of skepticism is now pretty widespread. People are starting to wake up to the business logic of the internet and how.
Dude, I hear about cars and stuff, though. I hear the arguments that you're making from very few people. And I'm one of the people who makes a lot of them, maybe not quite as articulately as you have here. But yeah, this sort of like, hang on, you know, everyone just sort of assume, first off, the cynical use of terms like autopilot and the media using terms like autonomous cars, which are absolute horseshit, is not helping. It's making things like way worse. And it's sort of this middle ground we're in where everybody's a beta tester and we're just like, okay with that.
I mean, the hype has far outstripped the engineering reality. And so you have cases like Uber. There have been now a few cases where Uber self-driving cars have hit pedestrians, and it emerged in one of these investigations, you know, by the Transportation Safety Board that the car had not been programmed to recognize a pedestrian crossing outside of a crosswalk.
Yeah.
And so you think, well, that's idiotic. Why would they put such a car out on the street? And I think the only reason is they want to be first to market. Whoever's first to market is going to take the entire prize. That seems to be the logic of driverless cars.
Well, it was the logic with Uber, the ride sharing model. Right. It was the logic with the house sharing model, Airbnb. You know,
No, go ahead.
It's called what?
Oh, they call it platform capitalism. In other words, if you own the platform, like, everyone wants to be on the same platform for obvious reasons. It's like you get this network effect, and it's, yeah.
But when you know, like, you're a motorcycle rider. I'm a motorcycle rider myself in California, where it's civilized to ride a motorcycle. You can lane split here. The idea that you can't lane split is in other places is so unbelievably ridiculous,
isn't it? I mean, how do you, like, it's just this, it's funny because obviously it's a little risky to split lanes, especially places outside of California where they're not looking for you. But the moralistic rage that you can provoke, you know, like people opening their doors in front of you, it's something.
It's the same, I think it's the same kind of person who decides that whatever speed they're going is the maximum safe speed that anybody could ever possibly be going on this highway. I'm in the left lane. I'm going 71, but oh my God, you want to go 74? Like, you speed demon. You know, it's everyone's an officer, you know, and making a roadblock. It's that same mentality.
Yeah. There's something about being in your car that I think encourages that. I think we're all susceptible to that kind of solipsism where you feel like the world revolves around you. Everyone else is in your way. You're kind of sealed off from others in your private property.
Yeah.
And yet we have to share the road together. So it has this interesting hybrid quality where it's both this hyper individualism and we have to cooperate. And that's one of the most
interesting. Your senses are heightened. You're moving and you're aware that you're moving and you're aware that car crashes are bad also,
Well, I think in some cars, you're far more aware of that than in others, right? The more massive and elevated.
You were driving a Morgan three-wheeler?
Yeah. So one of my favorite books is up on my shop bookshelf is from the 60s. John Muir wrote this book called How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive. Yeah. And he has this great line in there. He says, if we all drove as if we were strapped to the car like an Aztec sacrifice, there'd be a lot less accidents.
Yeah. As the owner of a Mitsubishi Delica cab over Japanese van, I relate to that 100%. And I agree. I drive that car real cool. But in LA, you know, and not to make this about LA, but LA is a great case study for traffic, for a place where a lot of the culture would happily give up driving. And then the rare, you know, the 10% like me who spend their weekends in the canyons and at the racetracks are, you know, from our cold, dead hands people. But everybody else would go, yeah, I don't want to drive myself to Hollywood on a Friday night.
And I can relate to that. If you're just, I mean, sitting in stop and go traffic, there's no fun in that.
Yeah. Where was I going with that? But, it's a good case study in how we would – so many people would happily give it up, and yet there's so much opportunity for surveillance capitalism combined with the confusion of what actually does improve traffic flow versus what just makes us worse drivers. Add on the fact that now we've got our phones and people have gotten so used to being in traffic that they sort of just resign themselves to the traffic, and they think that traffic happens to them. They're not active participants in traffic that can actively improve it. You know, they leave huge gaps and they're on their brakes a lot because they're not really paying attention. And you see this on your motorcycle. This is when you see this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. Apparently most traffic jams don't result from an accident. It's from small lapses of anticipation. You know, where someone is not looking 2-3 cars ahead and adjusting accordingly.
Yeah.
So they slam on the brakes and it just propagates backwards.
Yeah. It's the untrained, uncaring driver drives at the person's bumper in front of them. You know what I mean? Or just does anything they can to get around that because we can't be behind anybody. You know, and you gotta look through cars. But the other things that I think are also interesting is sort of this using safety as a crutch to justify the inevitability of autonomous cars while it really ignoring successfully implementable strategies that have worked for 10s and 20, 30, 40, 50 years, in as long as there's been cars in other countries. And in fact, sometimes you see studies, and I just saw it the other day in practice. I was so happy I saw it after I read your book, where I got to driving down Venice Boulevard, 3 traffic lights in a row, completely out. And yet there were civil, we treated them as stop signs and we civilly passed through with no cops present and no directions what to do.
That's the moment that I want us to learn from it because of what it means is that we can solve problems together without the supervision of some bureaucracy or a technology that does everything for us. And I take that intersection, this uncontrolled, you know, by lights and whatnot, as kind of emblematic of a certain kind of democratic virtue.
Yeah.
It's the ability to work things out. It's a little bit improvisational. We do it on the fly and it works just fine for the most part.
I read a book and the book was called Traffic. And it's a few years old, from the early 2000s. And
Tom Vanderbilt. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. It's the kind of book you would have read. And they reference a town somewhere in Scandinavia and where their experiment was to remove all signage.
The Netherlands.
Okay. Yeah. And it was fine. They had no, you know, it was a smaller town, but they had no problems at all. And it wasn't just fine.
It was a big decrease in accidents. The problem in that town had been cars hitting pedestrians. And as an experiment, as you said, they took out all signs, all curbs, all lines on the pavement, all lights. And what happens is people roll into this town and they realize it's all on them, so they pay attention.
It's remarkable how much people are actually kind of okay with having, you know, to be aware of what's around them, and when you make them, and it doesn't really become much of a problem. You have to drive, but I don't know. I think it's something about just addiction to our devices combined with the so many people being on the road and the traffic getting really bad in the last 15 years that we're just like, well, if we're going to be in traffic, you know, we might as well have an auto switch, right?
Yeah. And again, it's a totally, I'm sympathetic to that. If I had the kind of commute that was like that, I'd probably want one of these things.
But I don't think it's going to solve traffic as much as people think it will.
Well, the interesting thing is that for it to realize the gains in traffic efficiency that are being promised, you kind of have to have everybody in them because the cars have to be able to coordinate with one another.
Yeah.
And have rogue jackasses like you and me messing it up in our.
Right. You know. Car to human comms is going to be a real problem.
Yeah.
Now in places like Germany, with variable speed limits, you know, a few years ago, they mandated a certain level of receivable comms in the cars. Yeah. And so there actually really aren't speed limit signs anymore. Now the speed limit just comes up on your dashboard and it's changing all the time and it's changing on the conditions and it's broadcast from the, you know, National Speed Limit Center or whatever. But it's remarkably civilized, yes, but it really does require basically like 100% adoption rates. Like if you have an old car, like what, you know, you're kind of out of luck. There's no more speed limit signs. But that transition to a driverless car is gonna be nasty. That's a messy transition. Really,
how do you see that? I mean, say a little more.
With cars, with driven cars and computer cars having to speak to each other, our facial expressions, our nonverbal communications, like how do we talk to a car? You know, how does a car talk back to us other than like having like an LED?
Yeah,
it's like I'm turning.
So one of the sort of news items when I first started writing this car that made an impression on me was a Google self-driving car came up on an intersection. It was a four-way stop and it came to a complete stop and waited for the other cars to do the same before going through. But of course, that's not what people do. So the car got confused and just paralyzed and it couldn't deal with it. And it's interesting that Google guy in charge said that what he had learned from the episode is that human beings need to be less idiotic, by which he meant they need to behave more like robots, right? Strict rule followers. And completely invisible to him was the kind of social intelligence you were just talking about, where you make eye contact. It's almost a body language of driving. Yeah. But if you think the mind is basically an inferior version of a computer, then this is the conclusion you draw.
Well, that's what a software engineer would say.
Right.
And that's also where you really don't want a population of people. Is have you ever seen a movie that's good where the whole population is more like robots? Like, fuck no, that sounds terrible. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, and there's a bunch of dystopian movies where self-driving cars play pretty prominent roles.
Bro, I've said this before. We are through the Back to the Future alternate timeline, and we are now in the V for Vendetta timeline, and we are one work earthquake away from the Demolition Man timeline. We're it's there, dude. Look, the signs are on the fucking wall, man. We're there.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
It's funny until it's really, really, really not funny. Oh man. But let's talk about your backstory a little bit because I think you're coming from the right place to write this book for sure. I haven't read your previous book, Shop Class as Soulcraft, but after reading Why We Drive, I'm definitely gonna pick it up and check it out. What's your car background? You're sitting in front of a chassis.
Yeah, that's a, I don't know if I can, that is a VW hot rod I'm building. So air cooled old bug.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a 10-year project. It's going to make about 5 or 6 times the horsepower it started with.
Oh, it sounds appropriate. Yeah. I'm sure that won't be sketchy in any way.
Well, yeah, as you know, it means rethinking the entire, like top to bottom, just engineered everything.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, I think I see Coney yellows and I think disc brakes. And so your head is in the right place.
Yeah, those Wilwood four pots up front.
Yeah. Is that a hydraulic handbrake?
It is. It's a hydro brake. Yeah, I'm going to be drifting this motherfucker.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Because sideways is how I roll.
We could definitely be friends. Give me the quick rundown of your vehicular history.
Well, I started working at a Porsche shop when I was 15. It was before I even had a driver's license.
Cool. Where at?
This is in Emeryville, California, so the Bay Area. And obviously, I was never going to be able to afford a Porsche, but I got a VW Bug, 63 Bug. That was my first car. And of course, you know, as soon as I got it, I started messing with it and turned it into a Baja Bug. And I had this mentor who was a VW mechanic. He built like race motors and pitted for off-road racing. And he was this guy who had been like a long-haired vegetarian Buddhist classical guitar playing kind of guy. But at some point he went to the dark side. And when I met him, I was about 17. He was like a gun freak.
Like Hunter Thompson, dark side?
Well, he wasn't all performative like that. He was a quiet guy, totally alienated. But the one thing that he truly cared about was engines. And he kind of imparted that spirit of craftsmanship to me with regard to cars. Mm-hmm.
Would you say you're more of a driver or more of a wrench?
I'm more of a wrench. I mean, I don't have the skills of driving. I mean, I love to drive, especially sideways. It's been years since I've had something fun to drive. So in my mind, I'm amazing. And in this car, I'm going to do a lot of damage.
I had a friend named Tom, who our fans of this show will know very well, who had a car when he was younger, so a sporty Subaru, crashed it, and didn't have another car after that. But he would drive the press cars that I would get once in a while, but he'd only drive like once every 3 months. And when he got in the car, you know, he'd do a lot of racing simulated, whatever. Uh-huh. When he got in the car, man, he thought he was Senna. Every time he got in these press cars, he would just be like, I saw Colin McRae do this video. It's like, we're going to the grocery store. He turns off traction control. I'm like, what are you doing? I noticed in the book you went out with some of the drifters, who are some of my favorite people.
Yeah.
Is that what inspired you to put the hydro brake on your car?
Well, I watched those Ken Block videos. I mean, talk about art. That guy is an artist, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just the way he can put his car within an inch of where he wants it with four wheels smoking. I got to ride in a Formula D drift car around Virginia International Raceway.
That's the best, isn't it? There's nothing like that. It's wild.
So this is tandem drifting, you know, so they're like a few feet apart. And the cabin completely fills with tire smoke.
Yeah.
And then you're just in this white cloud, and they're still just on it, you know? They're just smacking the rev limiter, and it's like they're not, they can't see, but they don't care.
It's one thing to be able to get a car sideways, hold it, straighten it out, you know, do a nice slide, you know, then do it again, do it a couple times, repeat it, and go the other way. It's one thing to learn how to control a car in terms of being able to drift a corner. I can do that, and it took a long time to learn. But then, then to do it without being able to see or breathe.
With other cars a few feet away from.
Yeah. I mean, even I've been in those cars like that. And, you know, I've seen videos too. I'm sure you have as well of, you know, Formula One car in the wet, you know, and not the guy in first place, the guy in fifth place, you know, the wet where it's just like, okay. And this is the same thing where you have to just know where you are because you legitimately cannot see. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah. There was that. I was just watched one of those Formula One documentaries just the other night. Who was it?
Ferrari one that's now on. There's a Ferrari one. I think it's on Netflix now.
There's a bunch of them. Yeah.
Racing to Immortality. That's just about all the drivers that died racing for Enzo Ferrari. Yeah. It's really depressing.
It's crazy. And Enzo himself was like, he didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Like,
he was a
dick. You should go out there and you might die. And
yeah. He expected you to die for him like a gladiator, and then he also treated his paying customers like shit too. He basically treated everybody like shit, and he was rewarded throughout life for that behavior. Yeah, well. My favorite one is about safety. Actually, it's called just the number one.
That was the one I was thinking of.
That film fucking rocks. I've probably watched that movie 40 or 45 times. It's awesome.
Yeah, there's a quote at the beginning of that, or near the beginning, where I forget the guy's name. He was sort of a minor Formula One guy, but they showed this horrendous wreck that he walked away from, in fact, ran away from to get in a new car.
Oh, Martin Brundle.
Martin Brundle.
And 96 Australian GP.
That was it.
Yeah, he flew through the air.
And what he said that struck me, he said, at some point, it's incredible, it became unacceptable to die in the name of sport.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after that, there was a quote from, I think, Graham Hill's son.
Yeah.
So they're showing World War II, like fighter Spitfires and stuff. And what he said also stuck in my mind was, you know, after World War II, it became perfectly natural to seek glory in a vehicle.
Yes.
Making that parallel from the dogfight.
Yeah, well, that's when auto racing, I mean, we definitely had auto racing, you know, pre-World War II, but it was really an elite sport.
Right.
After the war, there became a much more of a demand for somewhat more affordable racing, and it really, really, really took off. But the tracks did not. Like in the middle 60s, the cars just got insanely fast, and they're basically racing on, you know, roads in the woods, and it's so shady.
Yeah,
but that's also. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say part of another thing that came out of that film is they talk about. At a certain point, the racing got very dangerous, and the organizers would say, well, if you think it's dangerous, just slow down. And they would put it on the drivers, which is so unfair. There's parallels in that to other things that we are seeing, like in your book and in other things in society, where it's like, no, if you allow people to just – you need to have come from an organization of safety and create those standards.
You're reminding me
driving suggestions, which I love.
What, say again?
Like your graduated licensing suggestions.
Oh yeah.
Which I love.
We can get to that. But what you just said reminded me of in ice hockey. I think it was maybe in the 60s or 70s. No one would wear a helmet, right? No one wanted to be the pussy wearing the helmet.
Right.
And so the only way they were going to start wearing helmets is if they made it mandatory. So you have to do that because of the social pressure.
Right.
And it's
Jackie
just like,
Stewart would be like lobbying drivers, like, please put your seatbelts on. And they'd be like, fuck you, mate. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they would. Yeah. And it's like, no, you got it. But you have Sid Watkins and guys like that coming in. And from the organizational level, and if
right.
they mandate that the car is safe, if
so
you
that's
allow
leadership.
A driver to choose a fast car or a safe car, they're going to choose the fast car. So you mandate that the car is safe. That's the point.
Yeah.
Graduated driving standards, something I've been a huge proponent of that I love that you brought up in your book.
Well, so other people are saying this. I just feel like I pulled out of my ass.
No, just like me and my friends. We're not like publishing papers on it.
Yeah.
So my idea. Give me your theory.
Well, you know, it's perfectly understandable. Some people want to get around with a minimum of involvement in a car that an SUV that weighs 6,000 pounds, and they couldn't be bothered with driving. Fine. Okay. So. If it's not driverless, here's your driver's license and here's your speed limit. And then at the opposite end of the extreme would be someone in a Lotus, you know, that weighs like 2,000 pounds. And he's able to put it into a four-wheel drift at will and slot it into a tight parking spot, you know, quickly. And so he would have a little more discretion in deciding what seems best in getting from point A to point B. And you could even make these different driver's licenses visible on different colored license plates. So
that was where I really like it. That was where you took it to another level, because now it's status that you can't buy, that you have to earn the status with skill. Yeah. Well, you could buy it in terms of a car, the correct vehicle, but combined with a skill level.
Right.
That's why people play. That's why people participate in Waze. It's because of the points. It's because they make it into a bullshit game, and you can have points. And if you get points on, did you know that if you get points on Waze for like reporting cops and stuff like that, that you get status on Waze? Did you know that?
I never even used Waze. And I don't know why, just lazy. But
in Los Angeles, Waze is very helpful because you've got an enormous grid and there are virtually infinite ways to get from point A to point B. So even if you know how to get there, where it is, you know, Waze will tell you the fastest way. And if you're on the highway, it crowdsources where police are. It is remarkably accurate.
That sounds great.
For that purpose. Yeah. But, you know, you can get lazy and you can definitely get it. But if you report stuff as an active user, they give you status.
Sure. Yeah.
And your reports get prioritized and all kind of stuff. They make
anytime you can enlist vanity in the service of the common good, that's great.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, like when Jay Leno would talk about the Prius, they're like, he made it ugly. So you could say, look at this ugly thing I'm driving for the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and that was what, you know, that's what Elon Musk and those guys figured out with the Model S, is that they could make a stylish thing where people could, you know, thumb their nose at everybody else and go, oh, you're not saving the planet with your gas car.
Sort of virtue signaling on the road. And since I moved back to the Bay Area, I started seeing these stickers on the bumpers of cars. It took a while before I could actually look at one up close. So it means that you have a virtuous car and therefore you're allowed to use the carpool lane even if you don't have other people in your car.
You know what? I had a Chevy Volt actually, and I got a carpool sticker on it. And I thought that was the shit. I was like, you think you're dope in your Bentley? Well, I can go in this lane and you fucking can't. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I feel that way now on a motorcycle and I have a lot more fun. Because you can motorcycle in the carpool lane as well, which is safer. But dude, no, the key to the graduated licensing plan is that different colored plate. Because now you've got a priority status symbol that you can openly display. Yeah.
That's right.
That's like very platinum. Good. Yeah. Except, you know, there's going to be like a black market for them shits. You know, there's like, it's going to be some, you know, you got to know you'd someone, that guy who or girl, whoever's in charge of that system would end up taking like the biggest bribes in the history of the state of California or something. Like that. You know what I
mean? Why is it that car people are so cynical like us? It's something to do with dealing with bureaucracy as much as we have to when you've got like six registered vehicles and you're spend half your life in the DMV.
At the DMV. What is your I liked your DMV chapter. What is your nightmare DMV story?
Oh God. I mean, it's remarkably consistent. You go there, first you stand in the standing line to get your little piece of paper that gives you a number. This is at least in Virginia, where I've been living the last 20 years. So it'll say E37. And you look up on the monitor and it says now serving A13, L19, Z, you know, 20, and you have no idea. This is inscrutable.
Cube. The letter thing is really a mind fuck, isn't it?
It's like it's designed to just make you resigned to your fate.
I can't even do the math. I don't even know. They might call Z next. I don't fucking know. I know exactly how you feel. That letter thing is the scam. It's like I make YouTube videos, right? And they don't tell you what the multiplier is. You know what I mean? If I turn ads on and I get 100,000 views, it's 100,000 times some multiplier that they don't tell you, and they just change. It's like there's no way to audit it. And this is the same thing as putting the letter at the beginning of that fucking DMV number. You have no idea. It probably categorizes something. It probably is like he's doing a plate return and she's doing a re-reg and they're taking a test. Probably means something, right?
Well, right. It's designed to serve the convenience of the people who work there. And that's understandable, but you know, on the other hand, is supposed to be serving the public. Yeah. And it'd be nice to know where you stand.
There's quite a few things that are supposed to be serving the public and haven't quite been doing that recently.
Isn't it interesting how once you start talking about cars and traffic, it's like a window into everything fucked up in society and right. also everything that's fun, but moving at speed.
We have a theory that there's a direct correlation between how much people obey how normal people drive and the authoritarian nature of their governments. You could draw like a pretty straight line, actually.
You gotta work that up into an article.
I don't want to be on a list.
You know what it amazes me? So in Virginia, you know, like everywhere else except California, no lane splitting. So it'll be 95 degrees. And there's the Harley guy sitting there sweltering in a traffic jam while a yard and a half of empty yeah. space next to him. And so across the wings of the eagle on his vest, it says freedom, right? Well, meanwhile,
in place.
Just sweating his balls off. Then you go to someplace like...
air-cooled bike.
Yeah, like Mumbai, and there's a family of four on a little 50cc bike, like weaving through.
Yeah.
And like just getting it done.
Third world motorcycling is the jam. And I don't mean to use third world in a negative way at all. I mean like the Far East and stuff, like getting on two wheels is awesome over there. Yeah. Their systems work. Like, I think
it's so efficient, right?
But we say that, but like, do we know that those systems aren't incredibly dangerous? Do a lot of people die over there and we're just like, yeah, it should be like that? And but like everybody dies and we just don't hear about it.
Well, you can look up the traffic fatality statistics for different countries. The WHO maintains that. You can find it on Wikipedia. It's interesting. Rome is one of those places where Americans go to and they come back horrified. Like, it looks like total chaos. Yeah.
Well, it's very old. You know, it's not as organized as a modern city. The streets are narrow. And Italians are kind of aggressive. You know, you got to be a little aggressive with a car there. Yeah.
And it doesn't look like they're following any rules, but their traffic fatality rate is lower than ours. So
it's because they're drunk and they go loose when they hit stuff because the wine.
I don't know. There's some
I'm just kidding.
Uncanny Italian hive mind where they're all able to predict one another's behavior, right? Because they're on the same page somehow.
Yeah. What about, but if you apply that to the Far East, I wonder if that, I don't know. I have done no research, but I wonder if it's like, you know, the school of fish, like in Vietnam, right? The school of fish motorcycles, where it's just this beautiful kind of moving mass and people move in and out of it, you know, and someone can just walk across the street and it'll just like, you know, part like the Red Sea to go around them. But do a lot of people die doing that?
Yeah, a lot of people do die because also they're not wearing helmets for the most part.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
So I think what you're seeing there is they're trading off some safety for a massive gain in traffic efficiency in terms of the use of the road surface.
That's how I feel about riding a motorcycle in Los Angeles. I mean, I understand that it is a little bit dangerous and I wear a helmet and I wear gloves and a jacket and boots, you know, but oh my God, the ability to say I will be there in 20 minutes and fucking mean it. You know what I mean? The ability to like, you know, I've had days where like my wife and I will leave the house. We live in Venice and we'll leave the house at the same time and I'll be on a bike or my Vespa and she'll be in a car. And after like, you know, 30 minutes, I'll text her and like, she'll be like 4 miles away and I will be on the absolute other side of the city. I mean, it's just impossible. And you know, the efficiency of it, the cheapness of it, the low consumables, the fact that like a $2,000 scooter will last as long as a $100,000 Mercedes.
And get 50 miles to the gallon, right?
Yeah, more. My Vespa will do 60. It's great. Mm. It's fucking great. I love being on two wheels. Like you said, your road usage is zero.
Yeah.
You're invisible.
Yeah. There's some weird mentality that's pretty prominent in the West, I think, that I call it the ideology of safety-ism, where the safer we become, the more intolerable any remaining risk appears.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there's no end to this.
Yeah, I mean, is that like you said? I mean, this draping anything in the cloak of safety could easily result in removing humans from the equation entirely.
Yeah.
And the technology of that, even if the morality is sorted out, will take a long time. But our governments and these private companies have already shown that they are more than willing to beta test all the way there. And like I said, that's going to be a messy ass process, because there's just like, why do people think that a computer is anywhere near as capable of driving as a human? Why do people think that? It's so obviously untrue.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of sort of concerted effort to persuade you of that. So Tesla is an interesting case, because here you have partially automated driving, right? The lane keeping, the automatic braking, and now the autopilot is the name of the package that includes all of these things, including auto steer. Mm. And when all that went live, the government came out with this claim of a 40% reduction in crashes with auto steer activated. It was like, wow, that's amazing. And there's this one guy who calls himself a forensic statistician, got very curious about this because it didn't seem to match what he could find from like insurance records with Teslas. He took him 2 years of suing the government to get the data. They wouldn't give it up. Turns out the government just got the data from Tesla. Once he cleaned up the data, he found actually a slight increase in accidents with auto steer engaged for reasons that are interesting we could get into. But
yeah, the long and short of it in the book was that it was a selective use of data. They pulled the crashes from this one and the auto steer from this one. It was a cynical use of the data.
And I think that's just one of those episodes that confirms the sense a lot of people have that these different elites that ought to be have a kind of antagonistic relationship, right? Regulators and industry and journalism. Sometimes they all seem to be in cahoots to push this narrative of progress that may turn out to be pretty sketchy. So, you know, I think it contributes to the cynicism of people about their institutions.
Yeah, but it's so weird that the cynicism seems so much there about the government than it does about like private industry. I feel like that is prevailing, I feel like it's because we've grown up on capitalism and the efficiency of business, and we've worshipped that. So, and people have not really stop to understand the fact that like governments are not supposed to run like a business. Like they're strictly services. Like they don't need to be like I don't want them to have like profit built into them. Like, and I certainly don't want to like just give it over to some like company that might be more efficient, but is, you know, turning an enormous profit margin on our data on the back end or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I think we still have this habit sort of thinking, you know, libertarians always think the government is the threat to liberty, right? But some of these technology firms have become like little governments, or not so little, right? So in terms of the far-reaching role they have in our lives, and so I think we just don't have the intellectual habit of looking for threats to liberty coming from these enormous commercial entities, but that's where the main action is now.
Well, it's where like if you go, I think that libertarian government threat thing, it goes back to like sort of 80s kind of Cold War, maybe even a little before that. But I think that what we're seeing in America now is almost like a post USSR Russia, where the technocrats are really getting to present this very liberal front-facing thing, and I've been in the offices of social media companies, and so I know. But on the other end, their policies are so buddy-buddy with what the conservative governments want and the hyper-capitalistic nature of all of it. The scenario you present in the book about what happens when your Google shopping history gets integrated with your car's GPS, I was like, oh, fuck. Will you spell that one out for us real quick?
Well, you know, you can imagine you can imagine that you don't even have to pay for rides in driverless cars. You just hail one, right? Because it's free. Well, not really free, because you get in and you have to spend the first 20 minutes declining all these offers tailored to your unique lifestyle, because the car wants to take you on a route that will take you past these different opportunities. There's all kinds of ways that you can integrate people's mobility with trying to nudge and herd their behavior into profitable channels.
Yeah, I don't even think you have to go so far as to say a free ride-hailing car would have that. I think if you have, you know, I think one of the things that Tesla has done to attract the non-car enthusiast super well is basically sell you a car that is almost like just a dock for your phone that's got wheels on it, right? So whatever's in your phone is just dumped into the car, and then it's sent right to Tesla, and you know, you that kind of stuff can all of a sudden become part of your normal routes, right?
Yeah. And it's the creepiness is, I think, the bottom line here. I mean, regardless of whatever the, you know, kind of nudging of your behavior, it's like remote control.
Yeah.
And that,
you know what always happens in all them movies? Every one of these post-apocalyptic, you know, future movies where we have a city full of driverless cars, you know what always happens about 20 minutes from the end of them movies? A human wrestles control of that car.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
A human, like, rips the joystick out and is now got control again, right?
Yeah.
Even in fucking Demolition Man, they're like, I need a 1970 Oldsmobile fucking 442. You know what I mean? Like, I need a car that's so analog it doesn't even have a fucking suspension or brakes. Like, let's go. You know what I mean? That's what always happens. The end of every one of these movies is, let me wrestle control back from this autonomous car.
Yeah, I'm keeping a set of Webers and a centrifugal advanced distributor on hand for when the apocalypse comes.
Have you seen The Last Race?
No.
It's a movie from the 80s where driving, early 80s, maybe 81 or 82, where driving is forbidden. Human driving is forbidden. And a guy has disassembled in his storage unit like a Porsche 962 Le Mans race car. Like a crazy Le Mans car, and he just like builds it in the garage and like mobs across the country in this Le Mans car.
How have I not seen this?
I only heard of it recently. He's being chased by a fighter plane. It's like, it's fucking ridiculous, but it's kind of where we're going. You know, I think people think that we're being dramatic, but I don't think we're being dramatic at all, because I really think this shit's already happening with phones. And the more we integrate our phone with our car, you know, that it's just going to happen more and more. There's no undoing this. There's no fucking way there's undoing this.
Yeah. And that's the feeling of, like, there's this sort of grid that's tightening around you in all these kind of opaque ways that are hard to even wrap your head around, and decisions happening somewhere else. And I think this contributes to this kind of populist moment that we've had the last few years. In fact, you could point to the yellow vests, which begins as an automotive protest. It's sort of against this shadowy establishment where decisions are just happening somewhere else, and it's a totally undemocratic process.
Yeah. And look, I don't think it's necessarily anti-gearhead to say that somewhere like Lower Manhattan should be heavily restricted with vehicle traffic, right? Like, I went to Amsterdam in 2018, I went to Amsterdam, and they've gotten rid of a ton of car traffic from the center in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And it is spectacular.
Yeah, right.
Quiet, the air is clean. You know, there's some EVs running around, but trucks can only go at certain hours and stuff. And there's a lot of bicycles. It's really bike friendly, and it's fantastic. And so the idea of going, yes, in our dense cities in Boston and Philly and downtown New York, like, let's do this. I get that. But then you think about the whole rest of the country, and it's like, that shit ain't going to work.
Well, I mean, one thing, if we had invested in public transportation and building the cities around that idea 100 years ago or mm-hmm. 200 years ago, but we really didn't, whereas in Europe they did. So, yeah, you can have a city with very few cars in it, and it works.
In Europe, I don't want to say this the wrong word could really get me fucked up here, but in Europe, transportation wise, did the fact that they had a massive rebuilding effort in the second half of the 40s into the 50s, and America really just built on our railroads, you know, and never had that wipe it down and start over with a new network kind of thing. You think that had anything to do with it?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the public transportation infrastructure in European cities is from before the war. It's like early 20th century. And at the same time in the U.S., we went all in on the automobile, even before afterwards. Most people had them. And then, of course, they had to rebuild all that after the war. I mean, well, the London Tube was one of the few places to survive the Blitz. People went down there to get away from the bombs.
Actually, you know what? I think you know what? That's, you're probably right. I think it may have had more to do with the fact that their cities are very old and the streets are very narrow, and so that may have just been what they had to do. If they weren't, unless they were going to widen every single street, you know, cities were built around a standard lane width and a standard parking spot size. And that's why I believe like smart cars didn't really take off here, because below a certain size, what's the point? Like, you know, anything smaller than like a Mini or a Fiesta is just like, why? You know, but we're pushing it now with the trucks. Fuck me. We got a problem with size of vehicles.
Yeah, you'll see these, you know, guys in their F-250s just diagonal across two or even three parking spots.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't fit these things in a city. I get it, in Texas and whatever, they're bigger, you can fit you there. But, you know, I really liked the book, Matt. Thought it was great. I really am looking forward to picking up Shop Class's Soulcraft, your other book, and checking that out. Give me that's pretty much about. Tell me, what is that one about? Shop Class's Soulcraft.
That's a case for working with your hands. It's a case for the skilled trade. So I used to have a motorcycle repair shop. I used to work as an electrician, and of course, I've had a bunch of white collar jobs too. And when that book came out 10 years ago, it seems like there was all this push to, you know, knowledge work, as though, you know, working with your hands is not knowledge work. Mm-hmm. I've actually been more intellectually challenged doing some of the trade jobs I've had than sitting in a cubicle. So it was a case for how cognitively rich and demanding it can be to work in the trades, and to make a case for it as a life worth choosing, you know, for a young person.
I'd like to read that. I think that's very interesting as well. I mean, I have a non-traditional job. It's certainly not a full-time desk job. I work outside a lot.
On the Angeles Crest Highway, huh?
Hell yeah. Or in the desert or racetracks or whatever. But I am always, having grown up in New York area and moved out to LA, I've met so many people that have really interesting Hollywood jobs, set builders and costume people. And it's like, holy shit, like you can do professional arts and crafts, really professional level fucking arts and crafts, wood, paint, plaster, and you can earn deep in the six figures and get an Oscar for it. Like, did you know that shit? And I go back to my old high school because I didn't really enjoy the traditional, not like math, and I didn't even like writing, and I'm even kind of a writer now. It turned out you can write like you talk. Did you know that? You can. But I go back to my old school and I go, guys, if you don't like this, like, if something you do like is probably out there, if you're willing to like learn how to do it pretty well, like you could do almost anything as a job if you get pretty good at it. You know,
that's such a valuable lesson, because I think most kids are sitting in school bored out of their minds, yeah. Especially the boys, you know, just to sit at a desk for 16 years.
Yeah. I don't recommend it. Yeah. I don't. There's people who are like going out and doing farms and shit now, and they're kind of, and they're all about it. You know what I mean? I get that 100%.
Speaking of Hollywood, you know Nick Offerman, the actor?
Yes, I know. I don't know personally.
Parks and Recreation and a bunch of different great stuff. He started as a set carpenter in Hollywood. Huh. And he still has a cabinet shop where he makes actually really beautiful furniture.
Really? Oh, yeah. I gotta check out Nick Offerman's shit. That's awesome.
No. So the reason I know all that is because Popular Mechanics hired me to write an article about him. So I went and hung out with him for a couple of days.
Oh, I bet that's so interesting. I love to find out stuff like that. Yeah. The best car factory, you know, I love factories, and any opportunity to go to a car factory is a good one. They're all different. Every time you go to a car factory, you immediately understand the cars that come out of that factory, even if they are otherwise boring seeming cars. And the best one in the world by far is the Morgan factory in the UK, where there's guys sawing wood and fucking belt sanding, and there's generations of guys working next to each other, and it's just the best. You've never seen anything like it. You go, I can't believe this is going on in 2020. These guys are making cars like this and selling them for $100,000 because authenticity is worth money. Real authenticity, you know. I believe that I have some optimism, though. I don't know about you. I have some optimism that as the general public moves towards automated eggs, there will, at least for our lifetimes, for you and I's lifetimes, be a niche for people like you and I who want to drive very engaging, lightweight, and responsive cars. And I think that if the major OEMs won't serve that market, that you will see people like Lotus and Ariel serving that market, and you will see continuation series of old cars, as well as entire sub economies on keeping, restoring, and maintaining old cars.
Yeah, that's already here. I mean, you can roll your own, so to speak.
Yeah,
make it exactly how you want it.
Oh, that's awesome! You don't use social media, do you?
No.
Good for you. How have you made it this far as an author and a philosopher of sorts and avoided that trap?
I don't know. I could sort of see it from a distance. Like Twitter was just getting going when my first book came out. And I was like, didn't interest me. And I'm so glad I didn't, because
you picked the right side of that one.
Get like trapped in it, and you feel like you can't get out, and then the witch hunts and the mobs that come after you. Yeah.
Well, if you dare to think, someone will have something to say about it. I think you chose wisely. If I was you, I wouldn't pick it up now. No. You have a good long form, and I you know, some books I go through quick, some books I go through slow, and some books I bail out in the middle. This one I went through really fast. This is a great read, Why We Drive, Towards a Philosophy of the Open Road by Matthew B. Crawford. And you know, take him seriously to use that full name with the middle initial and shit.
That's right.
Well, other than the book, where can we get the book?
Wherever fine books are sold.
Yeah, preferably your local bookseller. Call them and request it. That's what we want to do. Keep the lights on in those places. Dude, thank you for coming.
It was a real pleasure, man. Yeah. So, yeah, let's do it again.
I hope when this shit show is over, you can come see us in Los Angeles at Westside Collector Car Storage, when we have a new studio.
I think we need to maybe have a little grudge match up the Angeles Crest Highway once I get this bug rolling.
Oh, bro, you can go your bug versus my old
car.
Whatever
you want.
All right. I'll bring something old and overpowered. Okay. And also, you know, I need to put you together. Do you know Alex Roy? Do you know of Alex Roy?
No.
Alex Roy is a philosopher also. He's an author. He writes for The Drive. He's written a book, and he works in the autonomous car research industry. But he and I are working on something called the Human Driving Association, which is a small little outfit. Yeah, small little outfit that is not really doing much yet, but our time will arise where we will need to legitimately lobby Congress or whoever, local or national level politicians, for the rights of human drivers, which will ultimately be in jeopardy, possibly in our lifetimes.
Well, yeah, count me in.
Cool. No, after I finished your book, I seriously texted Alex and I was like, this is your guy. You got to get this guy on here. So thanks for sharing this hour with me, Matt. I appreciate it.
Yeah, again, it was a pleasure. So thank you.
Awesome. That's our show, Smoke and Tire Podcast, powered by Shout Engine. Get your own podcast at shoutengine.com. It's easy. All you need is a microphone, a connection to the internet, and ideally, something to say. Matthew B. Crawford, author of Why We Drive. Thank you, sir. And we'll see you guys next week. All right.